We know you love podcasts, but these days when it comes to support, a like on Facebook just won't cut it. So take action. Visit kcrw.com/join and, well, join. Thank you.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Forest fires and federal money. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The worst fire in Colorado history is only halfway contained, and fires are raging in Utah, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. Climate change is drying out the forests, creating fuel for fires expected to increase individual property loss, human misery, and federal taxes. Studies show that local government agencies allow development near dense forests, knowing that the cost of firefighting will be covered by Washington. We'll update the current outbreaks and ask, is it politics that's preventing prudent planning? On Red State, Blue State, later on, different futures for the Affordable Care Act. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. President Obama calls the Waldo Fire in Colorado Springs a major disaster, while blazes rage in five other states as well. The federal government will pay for most of the firefighting. Critics say that's one reason local governments allow housing developments too close to forests that are increasingly likely to burn. We'll hear more about that. On Red State, Blue State, after last week's Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act, California wants to be the poster child for implementation. Texas won't even take all that federal money. First, this news update. As widely predicted, Enrique Peña Nieto of the PRI has been declared the winner of Mexico's presidential election. As he did 6 years ago, Andrés Manuel López Obrador of the PRD has refused to concede. Tracy Wilkinson is Mexico City for the Los Angeles Times. Tracy, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. The PRI, once again, as we've reported before, ran Mexico for 70 years until it was thrown out by the PAN, the more conservative party, 12 years ago. 6 years ago, when the PAN candidate won again, Obrador of the PRD, the leftist party, refused to concede. Now he's doing it again.
Yes, a little deja vu, no? I think this time, though, López Obrador has less ammunition, and the results are not as close as they were in 2006. And just judging last night, the crowds in the plaza supporting him were not the same size. They were, a few hundred people, that kind of thing. So I suspect that he's going to concede before too long. So I think it's going to be a different. So he's not going to stage the same kinds of crippling demonstrations that he did in 2006.
Held up the implementation of government there for quite some time. So what do we expect then from Peña Nieto, who is saddled with the reputation of the PRI for long-time corruption?
Right, that's a good question. He's going to have to address that. It'll be an interesting test if he allows prosecutions of some of the more corrupt former governors and members of his party to go ahead. He didn't win by as big a majority as he had hoped, and so he's going to have to negotiate with Congress. It's not going to be a rubber stamp that the PRI used to count on back in the old days. So it's going to be a difficult road to hoe for him, because he doesn't have the absolute power that the PRI always counted on.
So did the PRI then not win a majority in the Congress, or just not a big enough majority to give him much comfort?
Well, it's still being counted, and they have this very complicated calculation where they, with proportional voting and that sort of thing. So we don't know exactly what the numbers are yet, but it looks like he will have a plurality, but not an absolute majority.
So in what ways and in what areas is that likely to limit his administration?
Well, he's been talking a lot about reforming Pemex, the oil company, the big state-owned oil company, and inviting in more foreign investment, which has been sort of forbidden for a long time. Those are exactly the kinds of reforms that the outgoing Calderon government had tried to do, and interestingly enough, it was the pre-blocking of them, but now he wants to do them. And so will the PAN and the opposition now go along with the PRI and doing that kind of thing? He wants to reform the police and the judiciary, the kinds of things that Calderon has been trying to do for a long time in fits and starts, with some success and some failure. So there's just a whole long agenda of reforms and changes in laws that he wants to implement that it's going to be a little more complicated for him to do now.
Is it going to be easy for him to sort of hide behind the opposition in the event that other members of the PRI don't want to see the same kinds of reforms that he does?
Well, that's definitely a possibility. He insists that that the PRI is united behind the kinds of reforms he wants to implement. But that's a good question, because there are a lot of those old, what they call dinosaurs here, you know, the old members of the PRI who were very sort of nationalistic and state control oriented, and they're still in the wings there, and so he'll have to either tame them, bring them along, find a way to get them to agree. In the end, could he hide behind them? Sure. I mean, that is definitely a possibility.
Last week we talked with you about the drug wars and 50,000 people who have died in the past 6 years with President Calderon's policy. How much change can we look for from the PRI?
I don't think you're going to see much change at all, certainly not in the short or long term. Peña Nieto throughout the campaign, as did all the other candidates, said that, you know, the military has a role to play and will have to continue to play that role in fighting the drug cartels and in trying to restore security in violent areas. He has said he won't withdraw the military until those regions are pacified and there's an effective police force up and running, which is a long-term process. That's going to take a while. He talks about creating a gendarmerie that would be made up of former soldiers under civilian command of, I think, 30, 40,000 strong. Well, that also takes a long time. So I think in the short term, at least, and maybe even midterm, we're not going to see much change at all.
Tracy Wilkinson in Mexico City for the Los Angeles Times. As always, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, forest fires and federal money on To the Point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Fires are burning in Utah, Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho. Now we understand in the Black Hills of South Dakota as well, where it's reported that a military cargo plane crashed after dropping a fire retardants. No indication as yet of what the six-man crew is facing there, if in fact they have all survived. Meantime, in the suburbs of Colorado Springs, residents and former residents are discovering what happens when a forest fire comes to town. Some cars are nothing but charred metal. Some homes are burned to the ground, while in the same neighborhood, other houses have not been touched. Jeremy Meyer is there for the Denver Post. And Jeremy, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what it's like to walk around to the extent that you're able and that the residents are able in some of those neighborhoods. I understand some 30,000 people were evacuated. Have any of them been able to go home?
Yeah, they've let most everybody back. There's some areas that are still on mandatory evacuation, but most every place is back. Fire is about 55% contained, and that number is probably going to go up. Once they get kind of the rains around it, it tends to go fairly quickly. But yeah, it's been a crazy, crazy fight.
Describe some of that craziness. What does it look like? What do you see? What are some of the contrasts?
Well, of course, they were definitely keeping the press out of the area as much as they could. So we didn't really get a chance until this weekend to walk through it. I actually did not walk through it, but you know, what you could see from the distance was just absolutely charred, you know, trees, very, very black earth all around this beautiful Colorado Springs city, which, you know, is renowned for its you know, its beauty. So they're going to have to deal with that for a number of years.
Why do you say they kept the press out?
Well, I mean, they were fighting the fire. There was areas that were very, you know, dangerous still to go in. But actually, I have to say, I think they were a little bit overzealous about keeping us out. I think they really, they wouldn't give us tours or anything. It kind of became a contentious little battle between the press and the feds who were, and the sheriff who was keeping the area kind of out, you know, out of bounds.
So the federal government's very much involved. Which agencies?
Well, the U.S. Forest Service was involved. The Army came in with soldiers and equipment at one point when it just got to be too much and they needed help. And, of course, there was National Guard was helping with the retardant drops, and so was the Air Force. They had a few of the slurry bombers going, the C-130s.
So is there a sense, then, that the worst is over, or with it only 55% contained, is there a possibility that it might flare up again?
Well, I mean, there's always a possibility, but in my experience, when they've kind of gotten at least, you know, over half of it contained, and they really concentrate on the areas around residences, it generally, you know, is over in terms of, you know, these huge flare-ups. There will be flare-ups within the fire, but the perimeter is what you're really worried about, and that's pretty much been, I mean, I think they feel very confident. Even though we're experiencing still dry weather, there's thunderstorms in the forecast, so, you know, that brings wind and lightning, and not a lot of rain, so it's just dry. I don't think, my hunch is it's not going to flare up there again, but it probably will somewhere else in Colorado. Western half of Colorado is extremely dry, and, you know, I'm just fearful that's going to go at some point.
And are those homes that have burned and the others that have survived, are those developments right up against the forest?
You know, kind of, it's, you know, Colorado Springs, really the half of the city is kind of built on the foothills. And so these houses were on the foothills. They weren't in the forest at all, really. I mean, they were just kind of surrounded by, you know, scrub brush and so forth. And this fire, which started in the forest, leapt two containment lines over a week ago. It was Tuesday that it blew up. So it leapt all these containment lines and just went into the city, which was, you know, worst case scenario for these firefighters. But it happened. You know, a 65 mile an hour wind came through and just blew the fire out of control. It was horrifying, actually.
Well, Jeremy Meyer, reporter for the Denver Post, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ray Rasker is executive director of the Headwaters Economics in Bozeman, Montana. That's an independent, nonpartisan research firm analyzing the costs of Western wildfires for the past decade. Ray Rasker, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
We've had a lot of wildfires in the West over the past decade, and it would appear they are increasing. Is that what your research shows?
It's hotter and drier, and that seems to be the trend. So we're seeing more fires, and we're seeing more homes involved in these fires.
Why hotter and drier? Does it appear to be climate change? Is there consensus about that?
Well, there's consensus that climate change is a big part of this. What there also is consensus about is that there's a real desire to live in the wildland-urban interface. People want to live close to the forest. So it's the combination of that. And then a few other past, management practices that have left in some forests some significant buildup of fuels.
Tell us about the fact that, because people want to live close to the forest, is that why more homes are involved in the fires?
That's why more homes are involved. So there's several important issues here. The first one is, you know, currently public safety issue, and my heart goes out to all those people in those communities who lost their homes. The second issue is what do we want to do in the future? In particular, how do we want to control the escalating costs? It's costing the federal government about $3 billion a year, twice what it was a decade ago. And about a third of that cost is going towards the defense of homes. So, for example, in California, where we've done some research, this can mean on average about $80,000 per home. Some fires, it can mean over $300,000 per home. So how do we prevent these tragedies from multiplying in the future? The real interesting point behind these fires is that in most Western states, Colorado, California, Oregon, Montana, more than 80% of the forested fire-prone lands have not yet been developed. So a combination of that with warmer and drier climate, and you can see that we're just seeing the very beginnings of how big this problem is going to get.
You're persuaded then that there's going to be more development closer to the forest. So why?
Well, it's a lifestyle choice. People do want to live in beautiful places, but it's also combined with the fact that there is very little cost accountability. So those who, the elected officials, those who permit the new subdivisions on fire-prone lands, they don't bear much of the cost responsibility of that decision. So the bulk of the costs are paid for by basically the taxpayer, the federal taxpayer. So that's through the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, and FEMA. And so if more of the costs were borne by those who make the decisions to build, then we'd see a very different pattern of development in the West.
What about other practices having to do with controlling the possibility that forests can burn?
Yeah, so there's several things you can do. One of them is thinning, and they're trying that as much as possible. Even places that have had thinning treatments, they can still burn. The bulk of the firefighting costs are really going towards protecting homes. Fires have been part of the cycle of the West for thousands of years. We'll always have fires. What's very different about it now is that it's warmer and hotter. And now we have homes in the way. According to one federal study, only about 2% of the naturally ignited wildfires are allowed to burn. So even though we have federal policies that encourage more fires the way we used to have in the past so that it would burn some of the understory and we wouldn't have these catastrophic fires, only 2% of those are allowed to burn now. And the main reason is there's homes in the way. So we can't even implement some of the policies that we'd like to have in this country of having periodic low-level fires that would treat some of those fuels. So our fuel buildup situation is getting worse, and we're building more and more homes in harm's way, and the bulk of the cost is not being borne by those who are making those land use decisions.
Ray Rasker, Executive Director of Headwaters Economics in Bozeman, Montana. Harris Sherman is Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment. He oversees the U.S. Forest Service. He's former Executive Director of Colorado's Department of Natural Resources. Harris Sherman, it's good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Do you agree with what we just heard from Ray Rasker?
I do largely agree with him. The building within the wildland-urban interface, as we call it, is a continuing and a growing concern. I recently heard that 40% of the new housing starts in the country during the 1990s occurred in this wildland-urban interface area. In my home state of Colorado, about one in five residences now are located in these areas. So it is a concern because obviously when we have catastrophic fire in these areas, you're dealing with a potential loss of life and you're dealing with serious property damage. So yes, we are concerned about that.
What about what Mr. Rasker said about local officials who, and I gather they are lobbied, obviously, by the building industry and by people who want to live in beautiful places, are essentially allowing this to go on without having to pay the price?
Well, first of all, this is a local government issue because these lands are located outside of the national forest and they abut the national forest. So the zoning decisions, the building permit approval processes go on at the local level. I do think increasingly there is a shared cost now that is involved in fighting these fires because local governments and state governments are increasingly being asked to step to the plate to assist here. Obviously, insurance companies are beginning to feel part of the pain of paying very significant claims. Homeowners are losing their properties in certain cases. And a lot of the other benefits that come from not having these types of fires, like protecting water resources, protecting transmission lines, protecting key recreation areas, which people want to come back to, we all have a shared interest in creating a healthier and a safer environment within these areas. So I see it going forward as a shared responsibility that we all need to sit down and figure out how we best protect these areas as we can. And we think in the future about what is the best way to go forward with new building or zoning decisions.
Let me introduce you to Kevin Jeffries. He's a Republican assemblyman from California's 66th District. That includes part of Riverside and San Diego counties, places where there have been fires. He's also chair of the Assembly's Rural Fire Protection Working Group, and he was a volunteer firefighter himself for 29 years. Earlier this year, he introduced Assembly Bill 1506, which would repeal California's new fire fee on rural residents. Assemblyman Jeffries, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be on.
That would appear, based on what we've heard today on the rest of our program, to be the wrong way to go. Shouldn't the locals pay the fee for fighting the fires near the places where they insist on living?
Well, it's a matter of your perspective. If you are paying property taxes in California, which all California homeowners do, you are already paying for public safety services. And to say that because you live in a different community, you should pay a higher rate or a higher tax sort of begs the question, well, then why shouldn't we talk to those folks who live in high crime areas and say, well, you need to pay a higher tax because you have higher crime and higher impact on our prisons? Either all Californians are equal or they're not.
What about the federal government? If it's paying as much of the cost of fighting the fires as we understand that it is, should people in New York and other parts of the country that don't have fires have to pay for the fires in California?
Well, you have to understand, you don't have homeowners who are residing, for the most part, in California. You don't have homeowners who are residing on federal lands. They may have federal national forests or parks in or near their communities, but for the most part, most Californians are not living on federal forests. They're living in rural communities outside of the large cities such as Los Angeles.
But they're next to the federal lands, we're hearing, and that's why the federal government gets so involved.
Well, of course. I mean, it is the duty and responsibility of the federal government to protect its federal forests, and that includes fire protection, of course. What's not spoken about a lot of times is you have a lot of the firefighting agencies, be it state or federal, who want to get in there and want to do fuel management. They want to get in there and thin out the forest because, as was pointed out earlier in the program, they're not allowed to have the fires burn anymore. So they try and do fuel management projects, and it literally takes years, I mean years, to get the permit approvals from the various oversight agencies to go in and do the thinning that needs to be done to keep the forest not only healthy, but fire safe. And then the second component, as was briefly discussed, is building and landscaping standards. Many local communities are adopting very strict building and landscaping standards that help protect those homes when you have these large fires.
Okay, hold that thought. Kevin Jeffries, Assemblyman from California, will return with him and with our other guests as well. We'll also talk with Michael Kotis, who is based in Boulder, Colorado, on To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. Fires are raging all over the West in Utah, Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, South Dakota, and, of course, in Colorado, where we've just heard that the Waldo Fire near Colorado Springs is now 55% contained. But a lot of homes have been lost there, and the issue is being raised as to who pays for the cost of these fires. Are they, in fact, are people being allowed to move into dangerous places without having to pay the cost? We're talking now with Kevin Jeffries, Assemblyman from California, who wants to repeal a new fire fee on rural residents, saying that the property tax, they're already paying the property tax. Why should they pay twice. Mr. Jeffries, back to you. Of course, California's property tax is limited by Proposition 13, and the fee is only $150. Is that really too much?
Well, it is. It actually is. One, it was imposed in violation of the state constitution by the legislature on a simple majority vote. That's an issue that the courts are going to hear as soon as the state attempts to bill the first property owner. We expect the fee will probably last about a day in the court proceedings and then get thrown out. The challenge that we face in California is severe. I mean, there's no argument that wildland firefighting is a challenge. But you also have to understand that there are restrictions that are not only being put on homeowners in the way that they can manage their own property as far as trying to thin trees out and keep the underbrush because environmental regulations, but also firefighters are impacted by environmental regulations and restrictions. You actually have firefighters being told they cannot take bulldozers in to fight the fire in some cases, being told that the air tankers can't be used because the FosCheck or whatever material they're using these days is not environmentally compatible, but apparently burning down the forest is. So you have some conflicts that are being built in here, and then the homeowner is being blamed for the entire outcome, and it's not a fair argument.
Okay, Republican Assemblyman Kevin Jeffries from California. Back to Harris Sherman, the Deputy Undersecretary of State for Natural Resources and Development, who oversees the U.S. Forest Service. How do you respond to that? Are firefighters, firefighters, restricted because they can't use bulldozers, because they can't use air tankers to drop retardants in some places?
That very rarely happens as a result of some sort of environmental requirement. For example, the air tankers, we do have certain general restrictions about dropping retardant within 300 feet of a water body because we don't want to face water quality issues in that water body. But when human life is at risk, where a serious property damage is at risk, we will go ahead and allow that to happen, and we will document where we have done it, and we will do an assessment afterwards. And for the most part, dozers and other equipment getting into areas to put out fires, almost always this can happen. There are some very removed areas, what we call roadless areas or wilderness areas, where we do not allow that, but generally speaking, that is not in areas that are close to the wildland-urban interface areas. So I don't think our environmental restrictions have been a significant impediment to trying to suppress fires.
So you can override them, in other words?
Well, we can in certain cases override them, and in other cases where we can't, as a general matter, they have been away from these wildland-urban interface locations.
Again, Harris Sherman, Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and the Environment. Michael Kotas is based in Boulder. He's an author and journalist. He's working on a book for Houghton Mifflin Harcourt about global wildfire management. He's been doing a lot of research on this. Michael Kotas, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Are the homeowners, as Assemblyman Jeffries suggests, being asked to bear more of the cost than it's fair to require from them?
Well, obviously, it depends on who you talk to, but it's a substantial cost. And one of the concerns is that very often homeowners are living in the wildland urban interface without really recognizing exactly how much of a threat they're facing and how much of a cost they're going to bear if a wildfire was to destroy their property.
Why aren't they better informed?
Well, a lot of the expansion into the wildland urban interface is from people outside the Rocky Mountain region here in Colorado. In fact, I moved here from Connecticut. One insurance agent that I spoke with a few weeks ago, where the Waldo Canyon fire is burning, explained that she has great difficulty explaining to homeowners the mitigations that they need to do to prepare properties if they're going to live in the mountains, and the preparations they need to make in case a wildfire was to come, because they didn't grow up in this environment. And when they look at a forest, they don't really recognize that this isn't an environment that's likely to burn. It's an environment in which fire is part of the environment. It's almost certain to burn at some point in time.
Do the homeowners who the insurance agent has to explain to refuse to pay or to install the mitigation or deal with it in whatever way they need to?
Yeah, it's been very difficult and it's very uneven. Now, there are some programs that have proven to be quite effective, like FireWise Communities, where communities get grants to put together plans to prepare themselves for wildfire. But it's really important to get a fairly broad buy-in among a community. Lots of fire mitigations are only as effective as the number of people that participate. In other words, if you were to mitigate your property and prepare it for a wildfire, but your next-door neighbor didn't, it's certainly possible that their house would burn and overrun the mitigations that you've done on your own. We interviewed outside the High Park Fire, which is north of us here in Fort Collins, and for about 2 weeks was the most destructive fire in Colorado history until a week ago when the Waldo Canyon Fire took that honor. And one of the people working on mitigations in that area and working on forest health in that area, actually the week before the fire broke out, had been working in a neighborhood there and went to homeowners and offered to do some mitigations on their properties. He was removing trees killed by the mountain pine beetle infestation there, and was roundly turned down. And then, you know, just 3 days later, the entire neighborhood was evacuated for the High Park Fire, and some of those houses did in fact burn that he had offered mitigation services to.
So there's a real question then of educating the homeowners. Who's going to be responsible now? Will insurance pay for the houses that were lost, or have you been able to follow up on that?
In the case of the most recent fires, I don't think we really know yet. Neither are have been completely studied yet. Outside of Boulder in 2010, we had the 4 Mile Canyon Fire, and that destroyed about 170 homes. And many of the homeowners there found after the fact that they were pretty substantially underinsured, and so they didn't they weren't getting enough of an insurance settlement to rebuild what they had. And then there's, you know, another issue with that, which is that a lot of people, after that land is burned and is charred and the trees that they moved to the mountains to be among are gone, aren't really that interested in rebuilding in that area. So you end up with a certain migration out of the wildfire-affected area.
Michael Kotas, again, a journalist working on a book about wildfire management. Let me go back to Ray Rasker, Executive Director, Headwaters Economics in Bozeman, Montana. What do you think of the FireWise program?
I think FireWise and programs like it that help homeowners protect their homes from wildfire are really important and effective and essential on land that has already been developed. But it really doesn't do anything to prevent the escalating cost of firefighting. And it may actually serve to enable future development. If the message we're sending is that it's okay to continue to build on dangerous fire-prone lands. Again, the key is how do we prevent these tragedies from happening in the future? And the only way really to resolve that is to think about how to bring cost accountability down to the local level where the development decisions are being made.
Let me go back to Assemblyman Jeffries, himself a volunteer firefighter for 29 years and now in the California Assembly. He's from the San Diego Riverside area where fires are common. What do you say to that, Assemblyman, and is it wise to allow people to build in dangerous areas, particularly if they don't know what they're doing?
Well, the question is, do they have the right to build on private property that they own and pay taxes? And the fundamental answer is yes, of course they do. The question is, do they have the right to build recklessly? And I think that's where the true battle lies here. The issue is local government, state, and local agencies, are they going to adopt and implement smart building standards so that we have defensible space? If they're not, then the insurance companies really need to step in because they're the ones that are going to face a larger brunt of the cost here and have incredibly high insurance rates. I mean, if homeowners are not going to do this smart and they're not going to protect their own property, then we shouldn't ask firefighters to endanger their lives to try and protect a home that the homeowner's not even going to try and protect. There's going to have to be some give and take on both sides here, but the bottom line is, as was mentioned, local government's going to have to do this smarter and allow property owners to use their property in a safe and safe manner. Otherwise, the local government needs to go in and buy the land up and say no more.
Well, why again not require the people who are the homeowners themselves, who have the benefit of living there, directly pay the cost of firefighting?
Well, and that's the misconception that that hasn't been brought out in this program. That $150 fire tax that is being implemented, proposed to be implemented in California, does not pay for a single firefighter or a single fire engine, not one anywhere in the state of California. The local government agencies, the fire protection districts and the counties, they're collecting another tax in many cases on their own for their local firehouses and their local firefighters. Those two taxes will be competing with each other at the local level when people start getting billed. And if they're going to pay a $150 fee or tax to the state, they're going to have trouble convincing those local taxpayers to pay another fee or tax to the local fire protection district that is actually providing fire engines and firefighters.
Michael Kotas, back to you. What do you find about the difficulty of dealing with arguments such as we have heard? Do they get in the way ultimately, not that Mr. Jeffries is responsible for them, but do these kinds of debates get in the way of better management of the land that we live on?
Well, I think they do to a degree, and you know, one thing that I've discovered in doing my research here in Colorado is that most local fire protection districts are increasingly underfunded. So it's almost irrelevant how it gets paid for, but the costs are falling onto fire protection districts that simply can't handle the fires that are coming their way. We had a serious wildfire very early in the season here, and you know, that's a big part of the problem too, is that the fires are starting much earlier when the federal authorities that bring in firefighters are not really fully up to speed yet. And this fire, the Lower North Fork fire, ended up killing two people. It was a prescribed burn that went out of control, and the fire departments that were responsible to go and respond to it really were only equipped to handle, you know, a wildfire of you know, maybe 100 acres or 200 acres. They're very small departments. They have very limited funding and very limited equipment. Most of them are volunteers, so they're having to wait to mobilize people with pagers and phone calls. And the fire was just, you know, way bigger than anything that they could handle. And, you know, with the economic downturn, property taxes have declined a lot in that area. In the meantime, they've had, you know, a pretty substantial increase in development into areas that are farther and farther afield for them. So it's really difficult for these local fire protection districts to handle, you know, any kind of big wildfire incident.
Let me go back to Harris Sherman again, the Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment. I understand that there is a plan to be revealed next spring about better management of the kinds of land issues that we're talking about. What do you expect to have happen? Will there be coordination with local and state agencies, or is that just overwhelmingly difficult?
Well, we have to obviously coordinate wherever we can, because the again, this is a shared responsibility, and every level of government is going to have to step to the plate, working with the private sector, working with homeowners and others to deal with these issues. I mean, we've got, at the federal level, we have approximately $1 billion in fire suppression. We have another $1 billion in our preparedness budgets. And we have lots of additional money that deals with post-fire effects of sedimentation, erosion, and flooding, and so forth. So we all have to work together on this. And if we don't all work together and we don't all put our shoulder to the wheel, we are going to have increasingly difficult times dealing with the climatic changes which are occurring. So the answer is yes. There will be a coordinated approach. There has to be a coordinated approach going forward.
And Assemblyman Jeffries, if these local agencies are underfunded, and if it's costing the federal government between $80,000 sometimes, or not between, but as much as $80,000 or sometimes $300,000 per house to save them, isn't a $150 fee relatively modest?
But again, you're making the assumption that $150 is actually going to help put the fire out when it's not in California. That's not the intent of the fee. That's not what it's proposed.
What's it for?
It's levied to fund their fire prevention activities in the CAL FIRE program.
Well, how about then getting attacks that would actually deal with the issue of firefighting and have the local people who benefit from the homes pay for it?
Well, and that's exactly what the local fire protection districts in California are arguing, is we are already collecting this tax for local fire stations.
But apparently it's not enough.
What is enough in California? Is $1,000 per home going to actually put out every fire and save every home? I don't think we're ever going to see that, no matter how big a tax is. One of the previous speakers mentioned the fact it's about cooperation and coordination between agencies. It's about allowing folks to get in there and do fuel management programs in advance, and it doesn't take years to get the approvals for it. You've got to have an overall approach to this, which includes going back to what I said earlier about building and landscaping standards that are going to save these homes.
So, Michael Kotas, back to you. As you do your research on this for Houghton Mifflin and Harcourt and your book on global wildfire management, do you see a new age where these agencies are better able to cooperate and work something out so that we don't have these, not just the enormous fires, which I take it are inevitable, but the destruction of property along with them?
Well, I'm sure all of these agencies really want to coordinate better. I think they all recognize that this is a problem that no one organization is going to be able to stand up against alone. But that coordination is incredibly difficult. I mean, just on the federal level, you're dealing with 5 land management agencies that have to cooperate on wildfires. And very often with these big fires, you've got a fire that's burning across private land, municipal land, state land, and then perhaps onto land managed by one or more federal agencies. So getting all of these various stakeholders to the table and getting them all to agree on what the resources and assets we want to protect are, and then getting them all to cooperate, is an incredibly challenging job.
So, Harris Sherman, you're Deputy Undersecretary of Agriculture for Natural Resources and Environment. You oversee the U.S. Forest Service. What about all these other agencies, and to what extent is it difficult, as Michael Kotas suggests, to coordinate well enough to see foresee some sort of end to this problem?
Well, let me just emphasize here. I think the coordination is going very well. I just came back from the Waldo Fire in Colorado Springs, and there was remarkable coordination between state, local, and federal authorities. I mean, everybody worked hard together. We had a unified command.
But excuse me, if I can interrupt you, that's after the fire has begun and after it's moved into the neighborhood. We're talking about what happens before that, so we don't have this kind of tragedy again.
Well, we do have agreements in place across the country between the different levels of government about how to fight fires. But beyond that, we have a much more complicated issue about how do we restore our forest to a healthier, resilient condition, so that when we have fires, they're low-intensity fires rather than high-intensity fires. That's a big issue. How do we get homeowners to step to the plate and be responsible for their property? At the Waldo Fire, the homeowners, the neighborhoods I visited, in most cases, there were not defensible spaces surrounding those homes.
And Ray Rasker, you're asking the question, why should people be there in the first place, not just if they don't take care of their homes, but because they're in a dangerous area?
Yeah, for me, it's a public safety issue, and it's an issue of preventing these tragedies in the future.
Well, thank you all for being with us. Ray Rasker with Headwaters Economics, Deputy Undersecretary Harris Sherman with the Agriculture Department, Kevin Jeffries, Assemblyman in California with the Republican Party, Michael Kotas, author and journalist, and our earlier guest, Jeremy Meyer, with the Denver Post. Good to talk with all of you, and thanks a lot for being with us. Our featured reporters on Red State, Blue State every Monday come from Texas and California. When it comes to last week's Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act, no two states could better dramatize the different reactions of Republicans and Democrats. Back in a moment with To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_kcrw.
Warman Olney back with Red State, Blue State on To the Point. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the Affordable Care Act was not unconstitutional, but it did leave some room for choice for states, particularly on the expansion of Medicaid. Wayne Slater is senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News. Carla Marinucci is senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. As always, it's good to have both of you with us.
Great to be with you.
Same here.
Carla, we're going to start with you. California wants to be the poster child for the Affordable Care Act.
Well, you know, I think there's a real lesson here. In a week in which we heard a lot of Republican governors on the tube this weekend, Louisiana, Virginia, Florida, talk about how they are not going to implement or at least may not implement this law until after the election. We got to remember in California, and that's the state with the nation's largest number of uninsured people, 7 million altogether, that it was a Republican governor here, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who moved after it back in 2010 to create the California Health Benefit Exchange, sign legislation. That puts California in the vanguard of this law. That puts California as a potential, I think, template that we haven't fallen off the edge of the cliff, as some Republicans may have suggested. And as of October, Warren, I mean, this healthcare exchange is going to start signing up people, enrolling uninsured people. So California has moved ahead. Really, no state is more prepared than California to move ahead with this. We've already shown that, and I think I'm wondering if California, as this debate goes forward in the 2012 presidential election, it serves as some kind of example. It was done here. Schwarzenegger and Democrats managed to put aside their differences and make things happen in California, and because of that, we're more ahead than any other state in health care reform.
Schwarzenegger, called, however, by some Republicans in California, a Republican in name only. And this, of course, is one of the reasons. Wayne Slater, with you back to you with the Dallas Morning News, or not back to you, but to give you a shot for the first time here. What about Governor Perry in Texas?
Yeah, let me tell you, I can't think of a more opposite experience, as is so often the case in Texas. If it's good for California, we think it's bad for people in Texas. And that's basically what the governor's doing. It's a just-say-no philosophy. Rick Perry is saying what other red state governors, like Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, Rick Scott in Florida, and elsewhere are saying, and that's essentially thanks but no thanks. We, in our states, and Rick Perry in Texas, says we are not going to do what Carla said folks are going to do in California, and that's begin the process of setting up these state exchanges. We're not going along with this. So the political message in Texas is we don't like the bill. We didn't like it when Congress passed it. We didn't like it when the Supreme Court upheld it. And so we simply aren't going to do anything at all until we figure out what happens in November. And if Mitt Romney wins, so goes the red state argument, then we'll just repeal the whole thing.
Carla Marinucci, where is California going to get the money to insure a large portion of those 7 million now uninsured? I think it's about 4 or so who are likely to be covered by the exchanges.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an estimated 5 million uninsured Californians who are ineligible for Medi-Cal, that's what we call it here in California, who are expected to buy coverage through that exchange. And right now, I mean, you're talking about a lot of money. I mean, look, the California Health Benefit Exchange has already gotten $40 million from the feds and is requesting another $200 million. It's going to cost, and the state expects to receive about $45 billion in federal matching funds, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. So is there money here? Absolutely. But I also think, is there support for the plan, and at least in California? We think so. And I have to say, nationally, I'm wondering, when you hear John Boehner talking about ripping out this plan by the roots, as he did this weekend, some of these polls are suggesting, maybe, I'm wondering, even in states like Texas, that may not be the will of the voters so much. Only in the most recent, I think, was Gallup poll over the weekend, only a third of Americans wanted the bill completely repealed. Only a third. And a new Kaiser Health Foundation poll that came out today said the majority, 56% of Americans, don't want this bill blocked. They want to move on to other issues.
So, Wayne Slater, in your state, in Louisiana, in Florida, and other states where they're not going to take the federal money, how do they tell their constituents that they are not going to take money that's supposed to be covering their insurance and helping them to get medical care?
Well, Rick Perry has done this before, not take federal money for various causes, saying that federal money brings with it strings that the state, and it's sort of our secessionist mode, doesn't want to fall into. I think for Rick Perry and for some of these other Republican governors, it is a very strong political message that they're offering up right now, that they're speaking to their base, a conservative Republican base. That doesn't like Obama, that doesn't like the idea of health care, the Obamacare, and believes at this point the Republican argument, or at least is willing to listen to it, that there are free market approaches that will work. But I have to say that at some point, in the event that Obama is reelected, if that happens, and we're early next year when the Texas legislature returns and decisions have to be made, the feds have already moved in by creating a federal exchange under the terms of the law, then Rick Perry and other lawmakers are going to have to do exactly what Carla just said, evaluate the attitude of voters as they better understand what this law would be, and I could see perhaps decisions that they're more pragmatic about Texas, but they're not ready to make those decisions yet.
And Wayne, just a few seconds left for this program, but what about Massachusetts? The Supreme Court said that the federal government was charging a tax for the Affordable Care Act. The Romney campaign is now saying that even though it's virtually the same in Massachusetts, it's not a tax?
Poor Mitt Romney. I mean, the guy is really stuck here. On the one hand, he can't say that this is a tax, because if he does, then he's being accused, then Democrats accuse him of being a taxer when he was the governor of Massachusetts. He has to say that it is a penalty, what he called a personal responsibility penalty, when he is governor and imposed it there.
Politics of Healthcare. Wayne Slater with the Dallas Morning News. Carla Marinucci with the San Francisco Chronicle on Red State, Blue State. Thanks to you both. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
PRI. Public Radio International.